Hello, this is 90.5 FM WHRW Sustainable Binghamton Radio. This is Zach Chastain. Unfortunately, my co-host, my lovely co-host, Hadassah Head, will not be joining us today. She is a busy person, a very important person, a powerful person, and she is indisposed. So, I have backup today. I have two guests who were generous enough to join me, and they are Professor Dick Rayberg of Binghamton University and Emilio Dolce of the Sustainable Development Planning Department at Binghamton City. Thanks, guys.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
So anyways, here we are. Today's topic is going to be centered mostly around climate change and things that are going on in Binghamton to address these issues, and generally things that we think are relevant and important related to that subject. So, yeah, I guess we can kind of start the conversation off on that very broad note. Professor Rayberg, do you want to explain a little bit about some of your work and your interest in this whole field? Kind of, it would be great to kind of hear how you got into this in the first place.
Certainly. I'd like to begin by saying it's a pleasure to be here with Emilia, whose work I have some knowledge of and really admired, and I think it's her work and the work of the mayor and other people in the city administration who do so much to make Binghamton a desirable place to live and a green city mm-hmm. and an example for the country. My interest in climate change goes back to, be exact, about 1988, which until that year was one of the warmest years in the 20th century. It was the year when Jim Hansen testified before Congress that the climate change signal was now obvious enough to be interpreted as real. Point of fact, the air conditioning had been deliberately turned off in the hot hearing room in the summertime. That was part theater, but what was not theater was his assessment of the state of the knowledge of climate change. And it indeed is real. In the past 100 years or so, the Earth's climate has increased by an average of 1.5 to about 1.7 degrees Fahrenheit. And the rate of that change has accelerated in the past 30 years. In fact, over the past 10 years, past decade, has been the warmest decade since we have begun to keep records. And accurate temperature records go back about 150 years. If we go even farther back than that through Paleolithic time, this is a relatively warm period. The projections, however, for now through 2100 give real cause for concern with what we call a business-as-usual scenario. That is, if we do not definitively, decisively, definitely, and substantially reduce carbon emissions by 80% by 2030, 2050 at the latest, projections are that the mean temperature of the planet will rise between 4 and 8 degrees, and that with the acceleration in the melting of the ice caps, which we have begun to recognize in the past 3 to 4 years, sea level will rise at least 1 meter, perhaps several meters. In fact, it is possible that by 2100, a significant proportion of the Greenland ice cap and or the Antarctic ice cap could begin to melt, not melt completely, but begin to melt completely. Would the Greenland ice cap melt completely? That alone would add 7 meters or 21 feet to the average sea level. I will conclude with this comment. Over the past 10 or 15 years, the sea ice, the summer sea ice in the Arctic Ocean, has been receding dramatically. And this year is scheduled to be the second year of the minimal sea ice coverage, Arctic sea ice coverage during the summer. In fact, it was either this year or last year that the first commercial freighter passed through the Northwest Passage. it does save a substantial amount of time in shipping goods from China to Europe and a substantial amount of money, but it also is a portent of things to come. If there is no summer sea ice, how is Santa Claus going to find his home when it is warm in Binghamton?
That's my concern.
Absolutely.
And it's a good one.
Absolutely.
Huh. And I do think I remember hearing something about certain contested waters. There's some melting, and I think Russia is planning to look to start prospecting oil in those waters where ice has melted.
Russia last year put an icon on the floor of the Arctic Ocean in its effort not only to stake but also to establish a legal claim to part of the Arctic. Between 25 and 33% of the world's undiscovered petroleum is thought to be within the Arctic, and there is now exploratory drilling off the west coast of Greenland for petroleum. Kind of ironic. We warm the world up so that the Arctic ice melts, and then we drill for more of the same stuff that has warmed the climate in the first place.
Right, yeah.
We do make interesting pacts with the devil, do we not?
It's hard not to get kind of religious about it. So that's a good start, is to kind of review some of the data, kind of say where the state we're in. I'm sure we're only hitting the tip of the iceberg. Wow, that's probably the first of many really bad puns to come. But the tip of the iceberg on some of this data. Are there any other, you know, points that the average person, because it's interesting that we hear so much of this through kind of a propagandized, you know, way. You kind of hear people arguing from one side or shouting from the other. It's kind of nice to hear information presented from more of a calm voice.
Well, I would just note that I think it was at or before the time Columbus either explored or exploited, depending upon your perspective, what is now the Western Hemisphere. Of course, he did not land in the United States. There was a Flat Earth Society. And there is little question among scientists today. I think there's little question among the lay public that the Earth is indeed round or a sphere. And to be quite candid, Zach, and I know that Amelia knows this, among the vast majority of world scientists, and now we're talking about 90% of all of those world scientists, for example, there is no question that the climate is changing. And secondly, there is no question that most, if not all, of that climate change in the past century is human-caused or anthropogenic. Those facts are simply beyond dispute. Mm-hmm. Some of the subtleties, of course, are subject to scientific argumentation. And science is always a changing process. Science seldom establishes a definitive truth. It is the nature of science to pursue the truth, not necessarily to establish it. But as sure as we are that the Earth is a sphere, we are that sure that climate change is in process and that much, if not almost all of it, in the past century or two, is human-caused or anthropogenic.
Okay, so setting the stage here. I like how you mentioned theatrics earlier, by the way. The turning the air conditioning off in the room. That's great. We need more of that sometimes, I think. But setting the stage, can we maybe discuss a little bit about some of the threats to global national security, how climate change is going to affect life on Earth, human life?
Well, we actually already are experiencing that. The conflict we have, for example, in the Sudan is in part driven by population pressure, and it's also in part driven by the progressive drying of the Sahel, that particular portion of that separates really North Africa from South Africa. What we are going to see in the next 20 to 30 years, in all probability, will be environmental migration on a scale that I don't think the Earth has ever experienced. Let me give you a specific example. Bangladesh, if my memory serves me correctly, is a population of about 30, 40 million, about right. On average, Bangladesh is 1 to 2 meters above sea level. So let's go back to what I said earlier about the lower projection for a sea level rise by 2100 by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Now, that was the IPCC report of 2009, which was based on scientific papers that had to be published by 2007, and we have more recent data which suggest even more rapid sea level rise. So we have a sea level rise, let us say, of 1 meter. That means then, on average, Bangladesh is only 1 meter above sea level. Bangladesh is prone to very strong cyclones, or we call them hurricanes in this part of the world. And with cyclones or hurricanes, you get storm surges. So Bangladesh is also prone to storm surges. So in an area of the world where on the Indian continent, for example, we have 1.2 billion people today, and by 2050, India will have about 1.5 billion people, which will be about 100 to 200 million poor people than China now has. China is about 1.3 billion people. We're going to have 40 or 50 million people in Bangladesh who are going to be looking for other places to live. Are the Indians going to welcome them when India is already having a problem providing enough water for its people, and when the Himalayan water tower is itself in danger because the Himalayan glaciers are melting? So the Chinese have a saying, may you live in interesting times. Well, the 21st century is a Chinese century. There's no question about that. They shall dominate the United States economically. They probably will dominate us militarily. They already dominate us in terms of producing more carbon dioxide, not on a per capita basis. But you're going to see some very interesting consequences of substantial environmental migrants. And that is going to be politically and civilly disruptive and will create a threat to the security of Europe and to the United States.
Okay. Does it ever, yeah, and Amelia, please feel free to jump in at any point.
Well, I mean, I think that the argument that Dick just laid out is very compelling as to why we need to be concerned about this issue and act now. I know that some people listening to the show might be very compelled by the issue of, you know, human displacement and human rights issues. Other people might not, and so I do want to offer some input on how locally we might be affected.
Yeah, please do.
Because I think that would be more convincing to us, to some folks. And I know Dick will have a lot also to share on this. But in particular, in our region, we could be seeing much more severe and frequent flooding. We're already seeing our 100-year floodplain, or sorry, our 500-year floodplain zone be turned into the 100-year floodplain zone. So there are a lot of homes that are now in a 100-year floodplain that weren't. And the
can you explain a little bit more about what that term means?
Sure. So the federal government designates a floodplain area both for 100-year floods and 500-year floods. So a 100-year floodplain is where is the most severe flooding that you would see in a 100-year period. The 500-year floodplain would be for the most severe flooding you would see in a 500-year period.
Right, okay.
So 500-year floodplain, obviously less frequent than 100-year, but more severe.
Right.
Okay. So we, in the city, we've got a lot of new properties that are going to be in the 100-year floodplain across county as well. And that's going to mean additional flood insurance for folks. Possibly anywhere from 500 up onto 2,000 plus, depending on the size and value of your home, and that's going to be a real challenge for a lot of our homeowners.
Right.
And you know, we certainly are already in a very challenging time economically, and this region has been very economically challenged for decades.
Right.
So this recession is certainly nothing new to Binghamton. However, it is, it's more severe than it's been. So that, in addition, that burden for floodplain insurance, for flood insurance for some homeowners will be very significant. With climate change, we could see even more frequent flooding happening. And especially at the same time where we're building more homes up in the hills, We are continuing to develop large strip mall developments that have a lot of impervious surfaces.
Yeah.
Yep. So what happens in a rain event, a large rain event, is that the stormwater then doesn't have a chance in those big parking lots to absorb into the ground. So it goes across the pavement. It can cause flash flooding. It might go into storm drains. Some of it's connected to our storm drains, which goes to the sewage treatment facility and that gets treated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, expensive to do, but also can overwhelm the plant in a large event.
Yeah. You don't want that.
Yep. But so, you know, the combination of climate change and unwise development patterns where we're cutting down more trees, covering up more surfaces with blacktop,
not good.
It is definitely not good for our region.
Right. And Professor Rayburg, you also have, I've thought about, done some thinking about the Northeast and kind of the specific impacts to the region. What do you think about this?
Zach, I happen to have, pardon me, I happen to have been working on a paper for the past 2 or 3 days. This is true. And
true
I think Amelia knows about that. In doing some of the research for this paper, I referred back to a paper by Thomas Carl, who is a known climate scientist and works for, I think, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Mm-hmm.
And Thomas Carl and his colleagues in 2009 published a report called Global Climate Change Impacts in the United States. And he also has a section of that that is devoted to the Northeast. And if you would permit me for a moment, I'll read some excerpts from that report because they
Please
speak
do.
Very specifically to what we can anticipate in all probability for the Northeast. Carl says that over the next several decades, temperatures in the Northeast are projected to rise an additional 2.5 to 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit in the winter and 1.5 to 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer. By mid-century and beyond, however, today's emissions choices, that is to say business as usual, which is to be specific, if the President and Congress continue to do with climate what they have done for the past 30 years, which is virtually nothing, that's business as usual, then we're going to have a very starkly different future. By late this century, Carl notes, winters are projected to be much shorter with fewer cold days and more precipitation in the form of rain. The length of the winter snow season for people who like to ski would be cut in half across northern New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, and reduced to a week or two, only a week or two of snow in southern parts of the region, in New York City, for example. Cities that today experience only a few degrees above 100 degrees Fahrenheit each summer will, by mid-century and beyond, have 20 or more days with temperatures of 100 degrees or more.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking.
And in places like Hartford and Philadelphia, they'll average almost 30 days per summer with temperatures over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Short-term, that is to say 1 to 3 month droughts, are projected to occur as frequently as once each summer in the Catskills and in the Adirondacks and across the New England states. Hot summer conditions will arrive 3 weeks earlier and last 3 weeks longer into the fall. Notice how late this fall is beginning. This is, what, October 14th. And have we had a frost?
Yes.
Two.
Mm-hmm.
Two,
yeah,
I think.
We've had like one or two.
Yeah, yeah. Other than that, it's been a very nice, comfortable fall.
Mm-hmm.
But it has not been the fall that we had up until the past 20 years.
Yeah.
And interestingly, and lastly, sea level in this region, I don't mean in Binghamton, not quite yet, but sea level in the Northeast, for reasons that I can go into if you wish, is projected to rise more than the global average. And we will thus have more frequent and severe flooding of densely populated coastal areas and cities. For students from New York City, that means more frequently flooded subways. And as I often say in discussions like this, if I were to invest in Boeing or in the Euro aircraft companies, I would be investing right now in jet float planes because JFK might be underwater more frequently than we would like to see.
And I think we should be very concerned about the rising temperatures, especially in our cities. We saw a number of years ago significant deaths, a significant number of deaths in Europe from the heat waves there.
Yeah.
And that's going to be become more common. And, you know, I know that some folks are not necessarily saddened by the idea of shorter winters, but that will have a significant impact on our region ecologically. Projections are that we will not be a maple-producing region in the next 20, 30 years if climate change keeps going the way it is, because the maple trees will not be suited for that kind of climate.
Really?
And in addition, it will have major implications for our agricultural system.
Mm-hmm.
You will see more frequent occurrences of outbreaks of different kinds of agricultural pests and funguses. If anybody's a gardener, you know last year we had a very bad case of late blight very mm-hmm. early in the season. If we don't have a hard freeze over the winter, that fungus isn't killed, and it will resurge very strongly the next year, even earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The last year it was really due to other causes, including the concentration of nursery production in the south and lots of seedlings coming through big box stores, spreading the disease across the country.
Oh yeah, okay.
But our state is very heavily. Our economy is very heavily dominated by the agricultural industry. A lot of folks don't realize that, but we are...
You mean the U.S. economy or the New York State?
New York State specifically.
New York State, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're the third largest dairy producer in the nation.
Right.
And there's a lot of other, you know, vegetable and specialty crops and livestock crops that support our economy, especially here in upstate New York.
Right.
Projections are that with the rising... the rising temperatures, dairies are now, and livestock farms, they're going to have to start air conditioning their barns because the heat will be too much stress for the animals. And so that's going to increase costs for farmers and the costs of the food that we buy and consume. So, you know, it's going to hurt our farmers. It's also going to hurt our pocketbooks directly through increased food prices.
Yeah. For sure. So, okay, so we're kind of putting together all these lovely pieces of the climate change puzzle.
May I add to
please,
to
add away.
What Amelia just said?
Let's get it all out.
In terms of agriculture, we remember this summer in Russia. Russia had one of its most, not one of its, but I think the most severe drought and the hottest temperatures in the Moscow region, but it extended over a significant portion of Russia, particularly the agricultural areas. These weather conditions this summer were probably record-setting. As a result of that, Russia has prohibited the exportation of grain from Russia, former Soviet Union. And in response to that, world grain prices rose. Now, recently, the Department of Agriculture has announced that the corn yield in the United States will be about 4% less than projected, although corn still is almost a record crop this year. The 4% reduction is because of a rather warm August, particularly warm nights. One of the characteristics of climate change is that as the Earth's atmosphere warms, more water from oceans and lakes is evaporated. And, of course, when you have more water in the atmosphere, you have more humidity. One of the interesting characteristics of the night, of course, last night is a very good example. If you went outside last night, we had a brilliant partial moon. The stars were very bright. It was a very chilly night last night.
Mm-hmm.
That's because there was low atmospheric moisture and very few clouds. So a lot of the heat on the Earth escaped into space. That is called radiational cooling. Well, as the Earth heats up and evaporates more water from the lakes and from the oceans, we have more humidity. We have more humidity at night. And thus our nights get warmer. Our days get warmer, but our nights get even warmer. And that is precisely what is responsible for the anticipated 4% decline in corn yield in the United States this year. Not so much warmer days, but warmer nights. I've just read some research on what happened in Russia. And as we remember also, Pakistan had record floods. Those two events are related. And while we cannot definitively say that they are because of climate change, we know, based upon very sophisticated climate models, that the probability of those events will increase significantly between now and 2100. So as Amelia mentioned, the European drought of 2003, the European hot spell of 2003, 30,000 deaths, if I recall, in Europe, record-breaking, those two will become more frequent. Extreme weather events will become more frequent. All one has to do is to look back over the past year, and I don't think we've had a week go by that someplace in the world, including the United States, we have not had an extreme weather event of one kind or another. Extreme weather events are going to become less extreme because they're going to become more frequent,
yeah,
and they're going to become more common.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I would love to hear the two of you kind of, and the three of us, like, how do you think Binghamton's doing, you know, as if everyone's a, you know, if everyone's looking at Binghamton, and how do you think we're doing in all this? Are we behaving well? Or are we behaving not so well? Or
Well, I could answer that in a couple different ways.
Please. I left it very, very open.
Well, first, just to give you some information, per capita, our greenhouse gas emissions per capita in Binghamton, they're lower than the national average. However, they are still significantly higher than...
Sorry to cut you off, but like just to clarify, when that statistic lower than the national average, does that mean like based on cities of like similar size, that whole thing?
No, there's a the Department of Energy has
actually ranked these.
The Department of Energy has developed an estimate of per capita emissions, greenhouse gas emissions for the country.
Okay.
And the city of Binghamton. Binghamton did its own greenhouse gas emission inventory. Myself and some interns that I had from this university, we did a greenhouse gas inventory and were able to total an estimate for the emissions that come out of the entire city, not just city government operations, the whole
community.
City.
Yeah.
And we found that while we know that our inventory can't be 100% complete, because that would be very challenging to do, we have a pretty good estimate of about where we're at. And in comparison to other cities like New York, Toronto, San Francisco that have used similar methodologies to develop their own inventories, we are higher than those cities. New York has probably one of the lowest per capita emissions in the country, simply because of the transportation system. So they're at 7.8 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent emissions per year. And we're somewhere in the 14 plus tons per capita per year. It tends to be lower in cities because you don't have to travel as far for work or for your goods and services.
Right.
And, you know, we do have public transportation such that it is. But certainly we can do better.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly we need to do better. And so the city of Binghamton right now, we're in the process of developing a climate action plan. So the first step in addressing our emissions and reducing them was to do that inventory so we know where we're starting from and we can create a goal for ourselves, an ambitious goal, yet realistic because we want to achieve it.
Sure.
But we want to push ourselves. So We have a citizen advisory commission that Dick is a part of, amongst other community members.
Oh.
And we are laying out a plan to reduce our emissions. We haven't set a formal target yet, but we're looking in the range of 20% reduction by 2020. Once we develop all of our strategies, we will see if we can't exceed that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're looking at every sector of our community, from transportation, our homes, city operations, our waste stream.
When you look at the infrastructure, I mean, I know there's, I think actually you might want to, isn't there a video or documentary that's going to be aired tonight on WSKG? What's it called? The New Metropolis?
Yes. Or did it air yesterday? Mm-hmm. Airing today.
I think it's today. I think it's today at 10 on WSKG. Oh. If you guys, if anyone wants to catch that, the new Metropolis, I believe. If not, you know, Google the New Metropolis, find out when that's playing. But I'm pretty sure it's at 10 tonight. But I'm not sure what it's going to address. But I imagine it might address this whole issue of the suburban infrastructure and the sprawl issue. I know, like in the city, you guys, your thinking, of course, goes outside the city limits because it has to, because it's interconnected.
Yeah, we only have the ability in City Hall to affect,
right,
you know, directly what happens,
right,
in our city, to make regulations affecting our community. But we're working, we're putting a lot of energy to develop stronger relationships with our regional partners,
mm-hmm,
to work on this issue together. Specifically, in terms of how this is related to climate change, we've been working with community partners, regional partners, to develop the Livable Communities Alliance.
Right.
To address how our land use planning affects not only, you know, climate, greenhouse gas emissions, but also how smarter land use planning can build a stronger economy for our region by concentrating development, concentrating business, developing a place where there's more to do for folks, so that, you know, when a business is looking to locate somewhere, they do consider the quality of life so that they can attract quality employees that are going to want to stick around.
Right.
So they want to locate, if they're looking for young professionals in their 20s and 30s, they want a place with, you know, lots of cultural events, you know, things for young people to do. And if we want to build that kind of place, we need to take our sprawling development and start concentrating people, stores, services, goods, our transportation system,
right,
so that it is a bubbling, urban, fun place to live.
Right. Because, you know, it's interesting thinking about, you know, this area as being the triple cities. And Vestal, of course, is, you know, that was kind of the heartbeat of this area for a long time, was Endicott, Johnson City, Binghamton, and then Vestal. Kind of, this is my Zach Chastain history of the Southern Tier, as I really sloppily understand it. But Vestal, you know, kind of started as our first truly, like, suburban community, and has kind of grown to be the Parkway. But I guess what troubles me is I feel like we do have a lot of hope in the city of Binghamton, and the actual city of Binghamton does have, like, it's a great place to concentrate a lot of our resources and to kind of restart and to renovate and renew. But then you have the cities of Johnson City and the cities of Endicott, which are equally important. And if we're not in partnership, mm-hmm, with them, are they just going to crumble? Or, you know,
certainly,
because they are cities. They're built as little cities.
Well, and
they're not suburbs to Binghamton,
right?
You know,
well, and we all do better when we all do better, right?
Right.
So we, you know, the city of Binghamton, clearly, you know, we have to serve our residents.
Right, of course.
But we recognize that a healthier, more vibrant region is good for our residents.
Better for everyone.
It's better for everyone. And it's been really exciting to work with our regional partners and other municipalities through the Livable Communities Alliance, and start discussing how, you know, we all recognize that, you know, folks that live out in the country, they love coming to Binghamton. They love living in the country. I love it living in Binghamton, but I love going out to the country. We don't want, you know, it's not Binghamton over Vestal. It's not Binghamton over Endwell.
And no one lives here
Green.
In that way. Everyone, I feel like most people that are residents here flow pretty freely between, you know, it's a very connected community.
So we want to maintain the quality and improve the quality of all of our communities to preserve what makes those different areas so great. So preserve the urban character of Binghamton, preserve its historic character and its beautiful buildings, its walkability, our great parks, develop new amenities like the river walks, and at the same time, preserve our agricultural land, the apple farms that you can go to and pick your own apples, and, you know, the beautiful parks that we have in this county. And, you know, and at the same time, you know, if we're going to have strip malls on the parkway, why don't we turn them into something better than a strip mall? Mm-hmm. Why don't we work to make it more aesthetically pleasing? Why don't we look at ways that we can incorporate, you know, work, play, retail, and housing so that you don't have to always drive to the parkway.
Yeah.
There's some housing there so that, you know, you're not just going and getting in your car to do your shopping, just like has been done in some areas of the parkway. But let's also look at supporting the local small mom-and-pop stores in Binghamton that provide a lot of jobs, provide unique services, and unique products.
Yeah, right.
And, again, maintain the character of our community.
Right, they are our community.
They are our community.
Right.
I would just like to add to Amelia's characterization of Binghamton that Binghamton and the area really is the jewel in the crown that is the southern tier.
Mm-hmm.
This is a wonderful place to live. And if I could expand also on Amelia's emphasis on the region, I'd like to note that climate change is not only a regional problem, it is a global problem. Because one molecule of carbon dioxide emitted in Beijing has the same effect on our atmosphere and our temperature as does one molecule of carbon dioxide emitted here in Binghamton. So we need a worldwide approach to this problem.
Yeah.
We tried that through Kyoto. We have tried that through the United Nations. But when you try to get 130 nations together to negotiate, we usually get spaghetti or mush. What is needed is leadership by the United States. We still retain some degree of moral authority and political suasion in the world.
Mm-hmm.
If the United States were to adopt strict, severe, definitive, substantive carbon reduction targets, let us say 80% by 2050, which is what the scientists tell us we must do if we are to avoid catastrophic climate change, neither the Chinese nor the Indians would say, as they have every right to do now, well, we're not going to do anything because you're not doing anything. So if the United States would lead the way, China would follow, and so would India. Europe is already ahead of the United States
because
in addressing climate change. I would add one other thing, that because we lack a coherent energy policy in this country, and we lack a coherent climate policy in this country, we are losing the green technology race, and we are losing it to China. China today invests more in green technologies than does the United States.
Interesting.
China leads the world in the production of wind turbines. China leads the world in the production of photovoltaic solar panels. China leads the world in almost all green technology. China knows that it has the most to lose from climate change. Although it is a major emitter, it is working harder than are we.
Mm-hmm.
For example, China has some of the best, very fast train systems in the world and is competing with the Japanese to build a very fast train linking San Francisco with Los Angeles. Where are American corporations? Asleep at the switch.
Mm-hmm.
Asleep at the switch. The world's fastest trains run in Europe, they run in China, and they run in Japan. 3 or 4 months ago, I was in Japan. I rode the Shinkansen, the bullet train, 160 miles per hour, as smooth as riding on silk. Where is the United States behind the eight ball?
I have a quick question about that kind of technology, that the light rail and stuff, because I don't know much about it and I've always wondered this. Obviously, it's more sustainable than automobiles, but how sustainable is, you know, over the long term are those systems going to be?
I think they can become very sustainable, especially because it is very easy to run trains on electric.
Mm-hmm.
And we can transition to a system where all of our electricity is provided by renewables.
Right, right. Okay, that's a good point.
And I encourage folks on this topic, if you're interested, the Livable Communities Alliance is holding its first event October 23rd at the Binghamton High School. We will be airing a showing of the film Beyond the Motor City, and it's about how the car both built Detroit and destroyed it. Built it through, you know, developing a metropolis around the car industry, and then as the car became more popular and more affordable to everyone, people started moving out of the city, right?
Yep,
and then at the
absolutely.
The same time, we started having industry going overseas, going south in the country. But there's a lot of focus on how developing a better, more efficient, and faster transportation, mass transportation system using trains can help to rebuild
cool.
places like Detroit and Binghamton by linking folks in the suburbs to the city, making it easier to come back into the city by public transportation, and also just making it easier to, say, live in Binghamton and get to New York City
right.
in, say, an hour by train if we ever get our train system back up and running and
right.
develop light rail. And then the showing of the film will be followed by a facilitated panel discussion on how this movie relates to our region. So it should be great. It's 1
yeah.
o'clock till 5 o'clock. October 23rd.
Okay, we'll have to make sure we announce that again. 1 o'clock, 5 o'clock, October 23rd at the Binghamton High School
mm-hmm.
auditorium?
Yep.
Okay, we'll announce that again at the end. So maybe this is a good time. If you have any closing thoughts, give them now. But then I'd like to finish the show with just what you suggest for how people can act locally on this issue.
I have a very brief closing thought.
Sure.
Last week, the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Binghamton, and I'm a member of the Green Sanctuary there, sent to the President of the United States, President Barack Obama, a real solar panel. We did that to protest his initial refusal of the solar panel from Bill McKibben.
Do people know about that? I didn't know about
it's
that.
It's been on all the media,
okay.
Fortunately, in Binghamton. About a week after the White House refused McKibben's solar panel from the Carter White House, President Carter put them on the White House. President Reagan immediately took them down.
Yeah, I heard about that.
President Obama wised up, if I may say that, and he decided to accept the solar panel. We decided to go ahead and ship our solar panel anyway. So it should arrive tomorrow at the White House clearinghouse, which is probably in Virginia, where it'll be checked for a week to make sure that it is absolutely safe.
Mm-hmm.
And we suggest in our letter accompanying, we have 50 signatures on the letter, if the president doesn't wish to add it to the set he's putting on the White House roof, then that he donated to a worthy charity in Washington, D.C.
Well done.
We do hope that the president will use his considerable rhetorical skill and his substantial intelligence to help the American public understand the nature of climate change and that urgent action is absolutely imperative if we're to have a world that is safe for our children and our grandchildren.
Very good. Okay, so what do you, Amelia, do you have any closing thoughts? Or?
I do, actually.
I just want to
say that clearly there are many reasons why we should be trying to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. At the same time, there are many reasons why we should be addressing, say, our energy use. And we don't even have to care about climate change. There are important reasons for reducing our energy use, both to cut household costs, especially in this economic climate, to make our region more competitive by continuing to lower the cost of living here,
mm-hmm.
And also just to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. Clearly, there's a lot of conflicts going on around the world over oil. And that in itself is draining our national economy, with the majority of our federal budget going to fight wars. So we should be trying to reduce our energy consumption for reasons well beyond even addressing climate change, though it's so incredibly important.
Of course, yeah. Because it is difficult for a lot of people to hold in mind these disastrous ecological consequences. But when you start to see kind of the more specific daily consequences and benefits of, you know, participating in the conversation, that's a great point. You should always keep those in mind, I think.
Certainly. And the less that you or I spend on our utilities, the more we're spending it here in our area at local businesses supporting jobs that are here rather than jobs that are, you know, say, around the world
right.
on oil rigs.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Zach, may I just a footnote to what
sure.
Amelia said? The number one foreign source of oil for the United States is our neighbor to the north, Canada. And we import 1.5 million barrels of oil a day from Canada from the Athabascan tar sands, one of the most destructive,
right.
environmental destructive ways there is to produce oil. But before we go blaming those folks in the Middle East for our problems, I don't want to blame Canada. I love Canada. The Canadians are wonderful people. We need to know that our primary source of foreign oil is our neighbor to the north, the good Canadians, eh?
Yeah, hey. All right. So with the last couple of minutes, would you guys make any announcements? I mean, I guess we can reiterate the Beyond the Motor City and any other groups that people should look up, students, community members. There's a lot of opportunities I know around here to get involved.
Certainly. I think probably on this show, folks have heard a lot about the Binghamton Regional Sustainability Coalition.
Yes, they have.
Which is a great organization to get involved in. In addition, there's a local chapter of the Sierra Club, which does a lot of great of educational educational events and also some advocacy work. And then also we have a really great local foods movement. And I'm putting on my other hat and my non-work hat now.
Put that hat on.
But Volunteers Improving Neighborhood Environments is a local organization working to build community gardens in the city of Binghamton and also has developed the Binghamton Urban Farm Project. We have work days every single week, multiple work days. It's very easy to get involved. Go online, vinescommunitygardens.org. You can find our contact information. We'll plug you into the work days and even help arrange rides. So if you don't have a car, we'll help get you to the work site.
Yeah, so that means if you're a student, there's probably other students that are coming that can help you.
Yep.
If you're living on the west side, as so many students do, it's pretty easy to get there.
There's a newly formed Vines group on the SUNY campus.
Oh, beautiful.
So there's SUNY Vines, so you can also find them.
Well, look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Brisk, vinescommunitygardens.org. Anything else we should see our club?
Well, let me put in a plug at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, 183 Riverside Drive.
Right next to the hospital.
One unit west of Lord's Hospital has a very active green committee. And you're welcome to check out the UUB website and come join us and work with us as we, along with the city of Binghamton, try to make this a better and greener world for everybody.
Okie dokie. I'm just going to announce the that event on the 23rd because I think that's going to be really interesting and really informative. That's Beyond the Motor City. It's a great documentary. It's being put on at the Binghamton High School. There's going to be a panel afterwards to kind of discuss how the video relates to local issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 1 to 5 on October 23rd at the Binghamton High School.
And for folks that are interested in finding more opportunities also to work on their networking and build their capacity to get maybe some jobs and internships, there's going to be a number of folks from local government agencies and nonprofits there, and it would be a good opportunity to get a feel for, you know, what kind of work you can go into from your mm-hmm. undergraduate career and also get some internships to even figure out what you would even enjoy doing with your life.
Because you know what? People that care, they need money too. And all right, so that's going to pretty much round us out for the hour. You've been listening to Sustainable Binghamton Radio. This is WHRW 90.5 FM. My guests today have been Professor Dick Rayberg and Amelia Dolce. Thank you guys so much for being with us. We'll see you next week.